Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
Corey Cabin Fever, not Griner. If I use that one again, I don't know. I'm losing my creativity. I don't even remember how I've introduced myself.
All the days are kind of melding together anyway.
Yeah, if I have used it again, it probably fits considering the times we live in.
Exactly. On today's episode, we've got a few different news stories we wanted to cover, including several Android malware stories, a crackdown on malicious Chrome extensions, and then a very poorly named phishing campaign. Let's go ahead and hop on in. So let's start with the first news story today. Which comes out of some research from CyberReason, where they just published their analysis of a new, still-in-development Android malware payload that they've actually been tracking for the last month or so, which they're calling EventBot. It looks like it's a mobile banking Trojan and an info stealer all kind of rolled into one, where it targets around 200 or so different financial and cryptocurrency applications that are installed on phones, and it also has permissions to read SMS messages, which means that it can bypass some forms of MFA, specifically ones that use SMS messages. Their blog post tracks the early development of this malware, and it actually was really interesting watching them go through. I think they started with version 001 as the first one that they detected. It was pretty basic, still had a decent number of malicious features, and then they followed it as the author added more and more features and obfuscation techniques. What are your thoughts on that one, Corey?
It sounds like an interesting bot. I mean, well, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about it, but it's interesting how it is able to get on the store anyways, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Lots of obfuscation techniques. It sounds like they use sometimes one obfuscation technique for apps, whether they be computer or mobile, is sometimes like the real legitimate app developers use tools to try to make it harder for crackers to pirate their stuff. So there's things like, I think the tool that was used by these threat actors is ProGuard, which I believe is like a legitimate tool for like protecting your app. Is that correct? So it's interesting.
Yeah, so it's really easy to unpack an Android app, it turns out. And unpacking it can let you see the original function names, which makes it, and class names, which makes it really easy to analyze it and see what's going on. And so this ProGuard basically replaces all the class definition names and the function names with just random, like letter AAA, AAB, AAC, stuff like that, which obviously an analyzer can still go in and see what the function's doing and rename it in their debugger to see what they think it actually is doing. But it does add an extra step, which can slow down analysis of them. And it looks like a few other like obfuscation techniques it used, which were pretty interesting, is that the original version, it started out pretty basic. It still used encryption to communicate with the command and control server, but all the malicious code was contained within that one application that gets installed. And with the second version that the author released, they actually added a functionality called dynamic library loading, where basically the main meat of the app doesn't actually do anything malicious, but there's a whole bunch of malicious code that's hidden in a font file in the like the data directory for the app. And so the main meat of the app goes and grabs that font file, decrypts it, and then pulls out the actual malicious code and then begins executing from there. And I guess one of the other side effects of this is it allows the malware itself to update its code without updating the app by just calling home to the command and control server, gathering a new data bundle, whatever it be, and then decrypting it and loading it in as well. Kind of interesting that way. We've seen a few other malware payloads do similar stuff to that, I think. It seems to be one of the easier ways to get around Google's automated malware checking, and hiding it in an encrypted font file is a kind of a clever way, in my opinion.
For sure. I mean, a lot of malware nowadays is modular and gets update packages from C2s, but it's scarily cool how this one kind of obfuscates its payload updates. But definitely something you have to do with mobile apps. Between Apple and Google Play Store, there's lots of validation of what apps can do as far as online connectivity. So it's scarily neat to see how they're trying to bypass those, you know, ingenious in a horrible way.
Exactly. And it looks like the authors of this malware also care about its efficiency, like how quickly it can run too. Because one of the later updates to it, it switched from using an RC4 cipher stream for encryption to using ChaCha20, which on modern phones is much more efficient in terms of encryption. So kind of, that was another fun little thing. Like, you would, RC4 is sufficient encryption. Like, it's crackable, but I'd say for a command and control connection, it's probably okay. But the author went to the extra lengths to add one that's really efficient and also really strong, probably to try and limit the resources the app itself was using.
I would guess it would help it hide, right? Like, if there's a sophisticated mobile user, they might use performance monitoring tools you can get for Android to try to find weird stuff. So it may not just be for pure efficiency of the application just to be good. It might be actually to help it hide, especially if the encryption's better.
As of right now, Cybereason hasn't detected this app on the App Store itself yet. They've mostly found samples by uploads to VirusTotal and detections through other means. But in some of the samples they found, the app icon, so what's displayed on the phone itself, was mirroring some well-known apps. Like, I saw it looked like Microsoft Word and Adobe Flash, and one of the apps itself was called like Adobe Flash Updater. So it looks like the author is planning on most likely putting it on the App Store as a, like, masquerading as a legitimate application. And I mean, if you dig deep enough on the App Store, you see plenty of, like, here's Microsoft Word, but they really aren't, not necessarily malicious, just a cheap, crappy knockoff. And this could kind of allow it to slip in there if they can get past the automated malware detections. So, tips on catching that one, though. As of right now, it's not on the App Store, but just basic Android malware or Android application security practices, the things we recommend all the time. Like, don't download apps from untrusted sources. Make sure you leave Google Play Protect enabled on your phone. It actually does a decent job of filtering out some of these things. And then you can even go deeper and check reviews for apps. I would say when you do that, make sure that, like, all the good reviews weren't just added in the last day or so. See if there's reviews from a further period back, because even malware authors that are trying to hide their stuff will do review bombing, like good review bombing on their own apps to try and pump it up. So there are generally signs you can look at to identify a malicious app. And if it looks sketchy, it's probably pretty sketchy. So next up in the news, somewhat related, at least in the Google ecosystem, is that the Chrome policy and anti-abuse team just posted an update about the Chrome Web Store's policies just last week. They detailed steps that they're going to be taking to crack down on low quality and misleading Chrome extensions. And some of the new requirements that they're stipulating in their policies are, for example, developers can't publish multiple extensions that provide the same duplicate experience or functionality. Extension metadata, like the descriptions, titles, icons, and developer names, must not be excessive, improperly formatted, or misleading. You can't have an extension whose sole purpose is installing or launching another app, theme, or web page or extension. And then also no extensions that are associated with the abuse of notifications, sending spam, ads, or promotions or phishing attempts. Like, it seems like, so they mentioned all this goes into effect August 27th of this year, and they're going to start removing apps that are in violation of these new policies. A lot of these, I'm surprised that they weren't already in place. Like, it seems like they should have already had a rule saying that you can't have an extension that abuses notifications and sends spam.
Yeah, it seems that one seems obvious. Now, there are some gray area apps, ones that can be used legitimately, but actually are also probably gray area where I think this would affect. I'll give an example. You know, one of my favorites is a YouTube downloader. And while I actually think that may be against YouTube's policy, which is why I think folks like Google and Chrome try to crack down on those extensions, can be very useful for offline viewing in my experience. And by the way, for those looking at YouTube downloaders, do know, unless you know what you're doing, it's a good way to get they don't necessarily come with malware, but they come with ad stuff and weird, like a browser hijack, you know, take over your default page. So unless you know what you're doing, you might be one to careful with YouTube downloaders in general. But I do remember when one of my favorite, you know, when I spent time making sure to make sure that I could turn off any undesirable features and that it wasn't too sketchy. They weren't allowed. They were kicked off the Chrome extension store for some of the reason, the techniques they used, which went against their policy. But then the way they found to install it is they allowed you to download, you know, they worked with this other extension that was really use Opera plugins as Chrome extensions. So the new extension you had to load was this Opera extension for Chrome. And then you would load the Opera version of the YouTube downloader.
Not sketchy at all.
No. And I wonder if this will actually close some of those weird little loopholes of getting, you know, extensions that may not be necessarily horrible. I have a legit reason for it, but can be sketchy in how they deliver it. And frankly, again, YouTube downloaders are probably against YouTube's policy.
And I know even outside these new policy changes, Google has been cracking down on extensions in the Google Web Store. Like just a couple weeks ago, they removed 49 malicious extensions that were stealing cryptocurrency wallet private keys. I think sometime in February, there was like 100 or so extensions that were sending spam and doing phishing. So it seems like it'll probably still be a bit of a cat and mouse game. I know Google relies pretty heavily on automated detection for a lot of these things. I don't think they have a human go through and look at every single app and everything single extension yet. And in my opinion, until that's the case, like there's still probably going to be some that slip through the cracks and will have to be removed at a later time when researchers find them.
It's good that they're trying to curate their store, though. While it occasionally gives me a little heartache when there is something I do want, for the most part, I don't run sketchy extensions, and I would rather Google keep bad stuff off. If you think about it, one of the biggest, I guess we haven't seen a lot of them lately, but man-in-the-browser attacks. I mean, using the extension subsystem is a good way to get a lot of powerful things. I mean, we're just talking about that Android malware that's all about stealing login credentials, browser extension frameworks, you know, anything that can give you power, man in the browser are a good way to do that. So it's nice that Google is policing extensions.
Yep, I agree entirely. And like with the man in the browser stuff, a lot of those permissions are there because like password managers, for example, need to be able to modify a web page to add a little button to insert your password. They need to be able to auto-populate form fields and identify form fields. And it's one of those things where it's a trade-off between having the user experience that you want and ease of use and technically having a security hole that needs to be watched. So next up on the news list, Kaspersky was, I guess, having a digital version of their security analyst summit today, thanks to the COVID lockdown, where they were disclosing their research into state-sponsored malware appearing in the Google Play Store, which was making it past Google's automated security checks for new apps. So they named this new campaign Phantom Lance, because I don't know why, and attributed it to Ocean Lotus, which is also known as APT-32, which is the same suspected Vietnamese government-backed group that we actually talked about in last week's episode, where they were linked to phishing attacks against China's Ministry of Energy Management to steal COVID-related information. Kaspersky, actually, before we continue, Phantom Lance and Ocean Lotus.
Yeah, wow. They're getting fancy with their names. Everyone wants some media attention. Let's make it a really fancy threat actor name. Although, granted, I like it better than the APT-32, APT-14. I mean, you know, somewhere there has to be some middle from really totally boring numbers to these fancy movie star names.
Well, in these fancy movie star names, it feels like they just went to like randomwordgenerator.com and chose like the two-word option and then hit go. So it's true. I don't know. I know sometimes they pull it out of the code. Like sometimes it has like Lance in the code and Phantom somewhere else in the code. And so they decide to call the threat Phantom Lance. But I don't know. It just seems silly. Anyways, so They were able to tie it to this group based off of reused code with other malware they'd seen previously. They believe that these threat actors were using the Play Store as a trusted source to where they would then deliver links to the malware in phishing emails so that users that or victims that received those links would see, oh, it's at least a quote unquote legitimate app on the Google Play Store, so maybe it's safe. They actually said they found tens of similar spyware apps dating back to 2015 that had already been removed. And some of those, like the authors of them, went to quite a bit of work to cover their tracks. Like they set up new accounts, which is pretty obvious, but then they even set up GitHub repositories of fictitious developers to make them look legitimate and help cover their tracks too. And in the end of the report, though, Kaspersky made a pretty decent point that Google already removed a lot of similar spyware from their Play Store, but their automated tools failed to catch these new variants that they just discovered recently. And I know you and I have talked quite a bit about like the differences between the Google Play Store and the Apple App Store in terms of how strictly they validate apps that go onto it. And this seems to be another example of Google's kind of lax approach allowing pretty serious malware onto the App Store.
So I'll be a not Apple fanboy real quick and think that I actually do think Apple's vetting process is better and sometimes has a bit more human touch. I think they both have automation going on to catch the things, but I do think Apple might have a human gate. But the non-Apple fanboy is, I actually don't think that they're doing it for security. I think because they're really strict about just pure financial and profit-based curation of their store, that the heavier touch comes from profit motive. But in the end, less stuff. I mean, they're just more restrictive of what they allow. And that does result in that those, even if those restrictions are about quality and profit basis and limiting certain functions on their platform, it turns out that that also means they do a better job of catching when malware actors misuse stuff. On the flip side, to be very fair, don't think the Apple Store has not had malware. Stuff has got past Apple curation.
It just turns out that it's typically a little less often on the Apple end. And like they have the additional benefit of like with the phone where you can't sideload apps unless you jailbreak it. So there's a lot less ways for unsavvy users to shoot themselves in the foot with malicious apps.
They also limit aspects of SDK. There's a lot of powerful function. You know, it used to be VPN. Now they open that a little bit more. But, you know, Google is all about letting their developers access pretty much every subsystem on the platform with a few exceptions. Whereas Apple, you know, kind of really limits what you can do on their system until they're ready for you to be able to do it. So, while again, I think their motive there may be more for controlling their platform, in the end, that does turn out to work well for security reasons.
Yep, and at least on Google's side, they do a good job of, at least in recent versions of Android, really granular controls over permissions for apps. So you can switch on, switch off different potentially privacy invading or security concerning permissions. That said, if you're running an older phone with older Android, there's a chance that it's got a vulnerability in it that could basically enable root access and allow the app to bypass a lot of those permissions. But either way, it was kind of cool research seeing that from Kaspersky. I'm looking forward to seeing their full report on it too, mostly because I'm sure it'll be full of even more fun names of hackers and hacking campaigns. Speaking of fun hackers and hacking campaigns, researchers at Group IB recently disclosed the details of a spear phishing campaign that has successfully compromised 156 high-ranking officers and organizations across the globe. They've called this campaign Persuasion. That's P-E-R.
Excuse me while I throw up a lid on my mouth. Sorry about the audio.
Persuasion. And it gets the name because it uses...
That's mixing a crappy word with a horrible pun spelling, which I'm sure you'll explain next.
And so, again, if we're going to pause here, I think Heartbleed is the one to blame for all this, right?
Absolutely.
One of the first like big vulnerabilities that got a fancy marketing name and fancy marketing stuff. And at the time, like, I honestly thought it was cool. I was like, oh, that's a cool name. That's a really serious vulnerability. but it kind of opened Pandora's box, and now we get all this crap like persuasion in here.
Well, let's be serious for a second and point out the positive of a name. The one key reason, and the one reason I think I would forgive Heartbleed, even though they opened this darn Pandora's box, is Heartbleed was this industry-wide huge issue. It affected everyone. It affected one of the most used, hopefully I'm saying it right, it was OpenSSL, right? Not as a... one of the core products that's in almost every other product too. It's open source that's used quite a bit. And I think if you take those researchers' side for a second, they really wanted to communicate that flaw to the world. So like the one excuse to use a really catchy name to get attention is, this isn't your run-of-the-mill, only affects this one product flaw. This is an industry-wide thing that everyone should know about. So, you know, if it's that level of vulnerability, and I guess the other one would be Spectre and Meltdown type stuff, you know, then even though you and I might scoff at the name they pick, you could at least give a good faith argument for the reason you're using that isn't to market, isn't for your own self-promotion, isn't to get press attention for self-promotion's sake. It's to get the world's attention because it's a big deal. And this vulnerability, which we'll get into in a second, might actually be medium, but I think there's a whole other side of it where people are like, if we give it a name, we're going to get more attention. And if it's not a big enough vulnerability, that's when I get a little more say, you know, besides just the bad name. If it really is a not the hugest campaign in the world, you're just trying to get noticed, then I have a little more skepticism for these fancy names. But I guess there is a case for it.
It is a bit easier to remember Heartbleed than CVE-2014-0160, so I'll give them credit for that. But in the case of this one, so it's not even a vulnerability, it's just a phishing campaign that they discovered, but it was kind of interesting. So the reason it gets its name, Persuasion, is because it actually uses Microsoft Sway, which is a newsletter service from Microsoft.
By the way, I'm glad you told me that. I thought I knew a ton of Microsoft products, but to be quite frank, until we saw this research, I had not heard of Sway at all.
Nor had I. And it uses it as part of a multi-stage credential theft campaign that starts with a PDF attachment to an email. So these high-ranking officers get an email saying, here's an attachment. They open the attachment. The PDF doesn't actually contain any malicious code. It's not like other malware we've seen or phishing campaigns where if you can get them to open the PDF, it tries to exploit something in Adobe Acrobat or whatever you're using. In this case, all it has is a link that's designed to look like a notification from Office 365 saying that this individual shared a document with you. That link then takes them to a file hosted on Microsoft Sway, which is designed to look like a Office 365 file sharing page. And on that page, the victim then clicks another link to log in, quote unquote, to view the document. And that link sends the user to a page that looks like an Outlook login page from May 2017. And it's got a form on there that looks like an official Microsoft login form, but if they enter in their info into there, it steals their credentials and fires it off to the attacker. It's pretty interesting how they use these Microsoft services to kind of add legitimacy to their phishing campaign. Like in terms of phishing, we've always given everyone the advice of, well, hover over the link, and if it looks sketchy, it's probably sketchy. If it looks like Microsoft.com, well, you can't spoof Microsoft.com. But now these days, because of all these hosted file sharing applications like Sway or even just different cloud storage solutions, it's really easy for a criminal to upload something malicious, even just a link to another thing, to a valid Microsoft or Amazon or Google or Apple domain, and adds a lot of credibility to their phishes.
I agree, and it's not the first time we've seen it. Some of your DNS segments that I think you've wrote for our Internet Security Report have stuff like this. That said, for the hover over thing, if we talk about some advice, I would like to point out that hovering over links isn't sufficient, but I think the key word is not sufficient. That does not mean it's not good. My personal advice is you still should be hovering over links. because it is a quick and easy way to catch a lot of stuff. And I think it's still sufficient in that if you're a savvy user hovering over links, I think you understand that links like SharePoint or OneDrive or Dropbox, these are the links that, while now you might realize that is a legitimate URL for that link, but maybe I do have to add a second check to that, which is this is some sort of public cloud service. Dropbox doesn't, you know, control everything on their site all the time, and this could be bad. So I think we should be careful in saying that, hey, hovering over and just noticing a legitimate domain is hovering over is still a good thing to do. Noticing a legitimate domain doesn't necessarily mean it's good. You have to use a second level of check. The other thing I will say is the only good news here is, while obviously this works, obviously these sites that have some sort of cloud user ability to upload things can't police 100%. I will say all these sites also realize that they're being targeted in this way. And they are trying, like even Dropbox, I used to use Dropbox all the time for a quick malware repository so that you and I or me and threat researchers could share
files. Isn't
that
against their terms of use?
It technically is, and I'm bringing it up specifically for the I used to part of that where we used to do it, and then we started getting it stopped working. They started adding technical mechanisms to look for this. You can still do it now, by the way, if you password a zip file, although technically that might be against terms of use. But the point I'm getting to is, while we used to be able to do this, these legitimate domains are adding technical mechanisms that are trying to police this type of stuff. They're obviously not perfect because persuasion, crappy name, continues to work in some extent, but at least they're still safer than a untrusted domain. So while I definitely appreciate your be careful just using hoverover as a way to know for sure, I do still think I would be cognizant of these cloud services, but they're at least a little better than a truly untrusted domain.
True. And I will say, in terms of this particular campaign, like, if you get an email with an attachment from someone you don't know, don't open that. If you get one from someone that looks like someone you know, like, pick up the phone and call them or send up a Teams chat or something like that, just outside of email, and confirm, hey, is this something that you need me to see? Is this legitimate? Like, that extra little bit of step can stop you from losing your credentials and spreading this persuasion phishing campaign even further.
Wee wee.
I think that's a good enough place as any to end. Everyone, please just go wash your hands and stay safe.
Yeah, I'm glad you ended there. I didn't say wee wee because I was French. I was saying I needed a break.
Hey, everyone, thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_, Corey's at @SecAdept, and the both of us are at #the443podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you will hear from us next week.